The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
A lot of people never dreamed that we could stay together. Some pretty strong personalities and some pretty big egos, mine included for sure.
W.C. Gentry talks about the Florida dream team of lawyers who fought big tobacco.
We saw the case really start developing as we kept pressing and getting the release of the important documents. And it turned from a products case into a fraud case, into a criminal, really a racketeering case.
And his concerns about the future of the profession.
I see cases that are meritorious cases that may involve $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, and lawyers just won't handle them. Because there are cases that need to be taken. I mean, legitimate cases where there's been a wrong. And they just won't take them because they can't make enough money.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I am Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. His mother was a smoker who died of lung cancer at the age of 54. So when W.C. Gentry of Jacksonville got the call to join a team of lawyers fighting big tobacco to recover state Medicaid dollars spent on those smokers' care, his was an easy answer. Their $13 billion plus settlement, the largest recovery in the history of jurisprudence at the time, led to an eventual multi-state settlement. As a past president of this organization, W.C. Gentry became a veteran of the tort reform wars of the mid-1980s that are still being fought today. Among his many honors is the Perry Nichols Award, the Florida Justice Association's most prestigious. It's given to a person whose perseverance, commitment, and unmatched dedication to the civil justice system is at the forefront of his or her life. W.C. Gentry sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in February 2018 to discuss his expansive career, the role he's played along the way in changing child abuse reporting laws, and his special interest as a civic leader in promoting children's literacy.
W.C., you were a member of the so-called Dream Team, nine Florida lawyers who took on the big tobacco companies in the mid-1990s on behalf of the state of Florida, which was trying to recoup Medicaid money spent on the care of ailing smokers. The group of nine, as you guys were known, won a $13-plus billion settlement from big tobacco. That must have been a very, very big high.
It was huge. There was an article in The Economist just a week or so ago reflecting on the significant decrease in smoking in the United States compared to other countries. Yeah, I'd like to think that we really did have a significant impact on public health. It was an amazing battle, and I've been going through my files, and I have just been amazed at the volume of work that was done by that small group of people. It was an incredible undertaking, and I am very proud of what we accomplished.
And you guys were facing hundreds of lawyers on the opposite side.
Literally hundreds, yes. And in the course of the case, literally millions of pages of documents were produced, turned over. And when we started, I mean, there was no question that the chances of winning were slim and none. And through a lot of really hard work, we got the documents we needed, the smoking gun. We started really honing the message. Ultimately, having the racketeering count was huge. And how that all came about in itself is an interesting story. But, we saw the case really start developing as we kept pressing and getting the release of the important documents. And it turned from a products case into a fraud case, into a criminal, really a racketeering case. And so by the time we had been going down that road very aggressively for over a year and were ready to try it, when Lawton Childs walked in that courtroom with about 300 prospective jurors there and you could hear a pin drop, I knew that we were in good shape.
What lessons for lawyers are learned from that case?
I guess really it sounds very trite, but if you believe and you're willing to make the commitment, you can accomplish anything. And we did. A lot of people today don't appreciate the challenge that we had. In retrospect, it all looks so easy, right? But Florida was the bellwether state. We were where the action was happening. Everyone stepped back and watched us, and because of our commitment to not enter into protective orders and the sunshine law we have in Florida, every document we got was immediately shipped to every AG in the country. And we became the catalyst for the nationwide effort. The settlement that was reached in Florida became the template for what became the national settlement. And so not only did we represent the state of Florida well, we created the energy and the catalyst for the national settlement. You know, I'm really proud of what we did. I wanted to put the industry out of business, quite candidly. Mm-hmm. And when it settled, I was happy that it settled. It was a good result. Out of the settlement, which again, people don't appreciate, everyone focuses on the dollars, but probably the most important part of the settlement were the concessions that they had to enter into in the consent decree. We killed Joe Camel. No more Joe Camel on billboards. We got rid of product placement where it could attract children. We put in place a lot of requirements on the industry that were never dreamed possible because it was not a regulated drug at that time and there was very limited regulation of the industry. And Lawton Childs, to his credit, would not settle unless they agreed to those provisions. And so that changed. No more television ads, billboards, cartoon characters, all that was gone. To me, that was probably as important as the money.
And what a powerhouse of attorneys, each one individually. That must have been quite an experience to work
together.
We
had a great group. A lot of people never dreamed that we could stay together. Some pretty strong personalities and some pretty big egos, mine included for sure. But we did. I think because we had so much respect for one another. I know I had never been good at delegating, but the job was just too big. And so each of us took on responsibilities. And Wayne and I, because of our being brought up through the Bedell tradition, where as a lawyer you did everything from investigating the case to signing up the client to doing the pleadings to handling the pretrial motions to trying the case to doing the appeal. We had a broad background, maybe broader than some of the other attorneys who were extraordinary lawyers, but really more focused on trying the case. And they were used to having other people handle the pretrial, for example. And so Wayne and I took on responsibility to handle all of the pretrial and oversee and direct all the pretrial.
And this is Wayne Hogan.
Wayne Hogan.
Right.
And we had this great Andy Burley from South Carolina, amazing lawyer who worked with us very closely. And then other lawyers handled the depositions. David Fonville, very few people realize the role that David played. He was in charge of the Western Front. He said, we're in charge of the Eastern Front, you're in charge of the Western Front. There were hundreds of depositions taken in Tallahassee by the tobacco industry and millions of documents. David oversaw all that. He would meet with assistant attorneys general every morning for different agencies and provide direction about what would happen that day. Tobacco was burning and churning its way through Tallahassee. And they found some damaging stuff. They discovered that the state of Florida had been involved in making cigarettes, something I didn't know until the industry broke it on us. But David was there overseeing all of that in Tallahassee. And Montgomery and I think Schlesinger were doing focus groups. Mayer and others were taking depositions. So we each trusted the other enough and had enough confidence in each other that we didn't worry about what else was happening in the case. We did our job, and then we would come together on a very regular basis and keep our momentum as a team.
You mentioned ego. Tell us about the role ego plays in being a good lawyer.
Well, I think you have to have an ego. And I think you'll find that most trial lawyers who are very successful have a substantial ego. You have to put that in your pocket sometime to get the job done. When you walk into that courtroom, the last thing you want the jury to think is that you think that you're smarter and that you're some kind of hotshot. By the same token, you want them to respect you. And so you walk in there with a confidence, but not with a, not with any sort of condescension. And I think the lawyers who are most successful are the ones that do have the common touch, but they have an ego. They want to win. They're competitive. They're effective. They do the things necessary to get the job done. And to me, that's all part of ego. You want to do a good job, and you will put in the time and the effort, the commitment to do a good job, because you're driven by your own sense of self-esteem. That's a good thing about ego. Ego can be a bad thing when it gets in the way of your judgment, and you start putting yourself ahead of your case, ahead of your client, ahead of your partners. But I think you have to have a strong ego and be willing to take the blows. That's the other part of having a strong ego. I mean, we don't always win. In our business, we get a lot of bad things said about us in the press. We're always under political assault. Sometimes in the courtroom, things don't go our way. So you have to be resilient and go home and suck it up and show up the next day.
You're a Jacksonville native. You grew up in the Springfield area, which is a very interesting area that's seen a lot of economic change over the decades. You're a Jacksonville University undergraduate, University of Florida, law school graduate, been practicing since 1971. What made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
I didn't really ever dream I would be a lawyer. I was hoping I'd be able to go to college. I believe in this stuff about we're all supposed to be equal, and every person should have access to the courts. I mean, that's been part of who I am and how I was brought up by my parents, and a sense of responsibility to our community and social responsibility. Who better to carry out those responsibilities and to champion those causes than lawyers? But fortunately, I did end up going to law school, and it fit me to a T, and I was successful in law school, and things have worked out well for me ever since.
What were your most important influences growing up?
Well, clearly my parents. My mother was a wonderful, sweet lady. She's really one of the reasons why I agreed to take on the tobacco case. She died at age 54 of lung cancer. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would have done it but for that. I really wanted to get those guys. And I saw the case in representing the state of Florida as the one best opportunity to finally do something about this venal industry. But my mom was a big influence on me. My dad was a real disciplinarian. He was a kind of a tough guy. He was a World War II vet. He grew up on a farm. He expected you to do your job. He expected that whatever you did it well. And you didn't take something on unless you were going to finish it. I think those lessons probably set in with me and inform a lot of how I approach what I do.
Did you have a mentor in your law career?
Nathan Bedell was my mentor. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. He loved the law. And Earl Zimmer, who went on to become a judge in the First District, was also my mentor. I owe a great deal to those two men and to the firm, because we all worked together. And if a big case came in and we were under a deadline, you know, it was all hands on deck. And so I got to work with Robert Smith, who is probably the finest appellate lawyer I've ever known. Robert had the gift of writing like no one I've ever seen. I know I would work and write and edit and change and get something home down so it was perfect and take it to him and watch as he would just dismantle it. But when he finished, what he did was so much better than what I'd done. So it was a great firm. John DeVault, who's still practicing here in Jacksonville, and Wayne Huggin and I were associates together.
Oh.
Quite a group of lawyers.
How did you go about honing your trial skills?
The only way you really learn is getting in the courtroom. And, of course, when I first started, I had mentors, and I was either the second bag or sometimes the third bag in the courtroom. They weren't really letting me do a whole lot, but I got to see an awful lot, and I got to see some great lawyers on the other side of the case. Being in the courtroom, obviously, was a great experience I had that many lawyers today don't get to have that much.
What's the most rewarding part about being a plaintiff's attorney?
You know, we're only equal in the eyes of God, and I think in the courtroom. That's the only place we find equality. And I believe that if you have a good lawyer, every man, every person, no matter their station in life, can have equality in the courtroom. And I get to be that person. I get to take on the tobacco industry. I get to take on federal government, state government, city government, Ford Motor Company, you name it. I get to go in the courtroom and bring everybody down to an even playing field. And if I've got a good case and I do my job, then I'm gonna win, and I'm gonna successfully represent that individual. There's no other place where you can impact, I think, society the way you can in a courtroom. And what we've learned is that not only am I helping that individual, but the impact of that case may have ripple effect throughout society. And I've been fortunate enough in my life that I've had a number of cases where we've made major social changes through individual cases. And so that's what I love about being a lawyer.
One of your fellow lawyers called you the most complete trial lawyer there is and a model for a trial lawyer. What do you think your key to success is?
Well, I really appreciate that, because I think to me the most important thing that I want to be known for is being a lawyer, a lawyer's lawyer, someone who can handle it all. I owe a lot of whatever it is that I am today on the wonderful training and experience I had coming out of law school at the Bedell firm. And Nathan, in particular, taught me the reverence of the law and the importance of doing the right thing and playing by the rules, not taking shortcuts, and being prepared. God knows Nathan Bedell was always prepared. And so I learned a tremendous amount from those men, and they were all men, and I carried those same attributes hopefully into my practice, and hopefully I shared those with the lawyers who came along through my firm. And I've been very fortunate to have some really great partners over the years.
How helpful or hurtful can self-reflection be?
Well, it sure hurts sometimes. I think you have to be self-reflective if you're going to grow. And I know I am. Some people who love me probably say I'm sometimes a little too hard on myself. I know I'm difficult to work with, and I'm hard on people who work with me, but I'm usually a lot harder on myself. But I don't know how you grow and you improve if you're not self-reflective. My biggest regret is I wish I were better at smelling the roses and enjoying the successes and the really good stuff that happens. I tend to spend a lot more time thinking about the things that didn't go the way I wanted them to and the failures than I do on the successes. I wish I could get over that. It'd be a lot more fun if I could just enjoy the good stuff more.
How do you handle disappointment? Because you can't win every case.
Well, you see, I think you can. I think you can. You should. I've always said plaintiffs should never lose a case, for God's sakes. We decide whether we're going to take it or not. We're not like a defense lawyer that has to take it whether it's any good or not. We choose the case. We investigate the case. We basically produce the case through the evidence we decide to put in. We get to go first every time, so we have the benefit of primacy. We get to go last when we make the closing argument. How do you ever lose a case, for God's sake? If you do a good job on every facet of that, the answer is sometimes we don't always choose the best cases, and we don't have as much control as I like to think. Sometimes the jury is just not, we can't win. I mean, sometimes there are things that move against you. But in reality, I mean, I've been very fortunate because we should win. But so how do you handle disappointment? I usually get mad when something goes wrong, and certainly if it goes a way that I just think is wrong. I usually get angry about it, and I kind of stomp around, and it may take me a few minutes, it may take me a few hours, it may take me a day. But then my reaction usually is, okay, we're going to fix this. And then I'm back at it. Mm-hmm. There are very few things I always used to tell my young lawyers and my staff. Listen, there are very few things that we can't fix. We're going to have things that go wrong. We're going to lose hearings. There are going to be glitches, you know, there are going to be potholes in the road. But we can usually come back and we'll find a way to fix it. We can't fix a blown statute of limitations, and we can't fix our credibility if we lie. But everything else we can fix.
You've had so very many notable cases in your career. Is there one particular case that you'll never forget?
I think the case that probably will always be the one that comes first to my mind is the Daubert case. I was a young lawyer. It was in the mid-70s. There was a man named John Daubert. His wife had been sent off to the what we call the pea farm here in Jacksonville. She was in prison for writing bad checks. He had four children. He took them all out of school. And how you can take all your kids out of school and the kids not go to school for over a year and no one know about it, I'm not sure. That was part of the problem. But during that year, he terribly abused all of them. Two died. And ultimately, a young boy named John, named after his father, John Daubert, escaped the house and was found. And we eventually represented the two children that survived, suing the city of Jacksonville. At that point in time, you could not sue the city for failing to provide protection, such as occurred here. We knew that. We filed the complaint. I worked with Robert Smith on doing the briefs. And the law was changed. And the court allowed us to go forward in that case. I then began a journey working with psychologists and others and really getting into this whole area of involving child abuse and what had happened to these children. Ray Ehrlich, who was a great defense lawyer, went on to become a justice of the Florida Supreme Court, was the defense lawyer. And I worked on that case off and on for 3 or 4 years. And we ultimately tried it. John DeVault, myself, and Kitty Phillips began the trial, and we put on our case for over a week, and it finally settled. But out of that case came recognition, both citywide, statewide, and nationally, of child abuse. And there were a number of statutes that were passed requiring reporting of child abuse. And I think it made a big impact on the way we dealt with children. You know, Florida's always been so far behind in terms of social services. And the way we still today deal with our foster children and our abused children is just reprehensible. It really hadn't changed, sadly, that much, I'm afraid. But at least now there are reporting laws and there's an opportunity to save these children. So that case had a huge impact on me. It was every aspect of being a good lawyer was involved.
You have been very involved with the Florida Justice Association, formerly the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers, for many, many years. You're a past president. You've won many of their top awards, the Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award for Consumer Rights, the Perry Nichols Award, the most prestigious by far of the FJAs. How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
It's had a huge impact. I mean, the Academy, it's always going to be the Academy to me, is the voice of the plaintiff's trial bar. It's also the voice of the victim and the consumer. If it were not for the Academy, I can't imagine what would have happened in this state in terms of rolling back and eliminating the rights of individuals. I mean, God knows there's been every effort to do that. But against, again, seemingly insurmountable odds over the years, the Academy has always been there in the legislature, in the courts, protecting the rights of individuals and preserving the right to jury trial. No one would have been there had it not been for the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers. It gave me an opportunity to work with other lawyers to get to know really great lawyers around the state. I mean, when I came up through the Academy again, I was so fortunate. I mean, we had J.B. Spence in Miami and got to know Larry Stewart and Mike Mayer and Bill Wagner, just really great lawyers who were kind to me, took me under their wing, taught me an awful lot about being a good trial lawyer, but just being a good person, too. and the responsibilities that we had to society. A lot of the development of the law occurred from 50s on. That group of men who came out of World War II came out and kept charging the beaches in the courtroom just like they did in World War II, changing the law, giving victims and consumers rights that they did not have. I mean, the law was really tilted from contributory negligence to the rules of evidence were tilted against getting things in evidence. If you were 1% at fault, you couldn't recover. I mean, all that law got changed. Sammy Cacciatore changed the law of contributory negligence. So we were constantly trying to push the envelope and give our clients a fair chance to have their case before a jury decided under fair law. So it was a huge impact on me, and of course I got involved with the leadership, and I really enjoyed that. And it gave us a way to hopefully give back a little bit, since we were much from this as lawyers.
Sure. And you worked on some very big issues.
We had huge issues. That was the tort reform wars back when Sammy was president in 85, I was president in 86, and that's when all hell broke loose. And it's been a constant war ever since, but it really peaked in 85 and 86.
As you've mentioned before, this is a tough profession. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
Well, I think that's a huge challenge, and I don't know that I've done a great job of it all the time. I was very, very fortunate. I had a wife that was supportive, stayed at home once we had the girls. And I had three daughters who I'm amazingly proud of, and that's probably the best thing I've ever done. All three of my daughters are successful. They've got families of their own.
One is a trial attorney.
One is a trial lawyer. One is a school teacher. One is a veterinarian. And I mean, three for three. I know their mother played a major role in that. It was hard to balance the profession. But every minute I wasn't practicing law, I was with my family. And I think you have to learn how to work hard, but then when you get those breaks, you have to devote it. It's hard to do this and have a family at all. So there's no room for anything for me at that point in time. I was either working or I was with the family. And anytime we got any kind of break, if a case settled, I'd take a day or two and we would take off together.
WC, looking forward, what's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have any concerns?
I worry that this day and time, and you know, advertising has its place, and I don't criticize some of the major advertising firms who have great law firms. I do criticize those outfits that don't really try cases; they just run up the business. But we've got some great Morgan & Morgan. I know he's got a great law firm, some really, really fine lawyers, and of course John is an amazing businessman. But I worry that we've become overly focused on the business end and less focused on the professional end. I worry about the courts and preserving the independence of the courts, which are under constant attack by the legislature. I don't know how much merit means anymore as opposed to public relations and getting the business.
Well, has the law become too much of a business versus a force for societal benefit and change? I mean, one is more profit motivated, the other one is more client motivated.
I worry about that. I do believe that, and I see it every day. I see cases that are meritorious cases that may involve $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, and lawyers just won't handle them. Because there are cases that need to be taken. I mean, legitimate cases where there's been a wrong. And they just won't take them because they can't make enough money. I don't see the dedication to representing the interest of the injured person, the interests of society. I see more dedication to figuring out how to make a buck. Not all lawyers, but I see more of that than I used to see.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
No. The end never justifies the means. Because once you start down that slippery slope, you lose your credibility and your ability to be a truth sayer. And I will go to other lawyers. Usually, I used to go to older lawyers. It's kind of hard to find an older lawyer today. But I would go to some of my mentors and sit down and say, look, I've got this problem. I've been asked these questions in interrogatories. I now know this. What do I do? This is detrimental to my case. And we would talk it through. And sometimes you just got to suck it up and do the right thing.
What one piece of advice do you have for incoming lawyers?
I think the credibility of the lawyer, the credibility of the client, the credibility of your case is the most important thing in presenting a case and ultimately being successful. I know lawyers that seem to take shortcuts sometime in the way they argue things to judges. It only takes one time for that judge to doubt your honesty or your credibility or your being straightforward with him. One time. He'll never forget it.
WC, community service is very important to you. I know, and here in Jacksonville, you're almost better known as an active community leader than a trial attorney, especially among the non-legal community. You've been a guiding hand in all of the major civic initiatives over the last 25, 30 years. You helped establish Jacksonville's first ethics commission. You spent 4 years on the Duval County School Board, the last one as chairman, and that is an often thankless job. And then relatively recently, you founded a nonprofit Read It Forward Jacksonville Coalition. Tell me about the public education part.
I've always enjoyed teaching. Probably would have been a teacher and a coach in high school if Vietnam War didn't intervene and I went back to law school so I could finish up my reserve officer training. When we look at the poverty we see in the city, the same poverty that's existed since I was a boy growing up in the same places involving the same demographics, when we see that around the country, the only way out of it is to teach our children, to give them a good education so they can raise themselves up. And we don't do it. We fail over and over again. We can pretty much seize the moment during the first 8 or 9 years of their life, because if we have done our job, prepared them and given them the gift of being able to read, by the time they leave elementary school, they can make it. One of my regrets is I just don't seem to have been very successful in this area. It's been a tremendous frustration that, you know, it's one step forward and two steps back. But we'll just keep on.
WC, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, as a lawyer, I'd like to be remembered as a lawyer's lawyer. Someone who had the skills to do it all and do it competently. And I'd like to be remembered as someone whose words you could always trust.
W.C. Gentry, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.